Now, before the 6 weeks, we talked about romanticism and nature. And now we must come to the second part of romanticism, romanticism and history. The romantics, as I said last time, above all worshipped a far and distant past, the Middle Ages, and they did this for several reasons. First of all, in their search for what they believed was a true community, a community still based on the emotions rather than on rules and regulations, like the modern state. And so and almost of necessity, they went to an idealized picture of the Middle Ages, where government and Christianity met, or where they thought government and Christianity were the same. And the community of man was linked in government through Christianity, through the emotionalism of Christianity, through the mysteries of religion. Now, why this should happen, this search for the Middle Ages, as we might call it, should be clear to you from your Werther reading. It was an attempt to mitigate the loneliness, an attempt to say that nature is not enough. Nature is not enough. We need a community of people, a community to which we can integrate. After all, if you take Werther, Werther's integration with nature was total. But it ended, of course, in Werther's death. So that the search was for some kind of controlling mechanism which might make a firmer integration, not with rules and regulations, not with what they would have called modernity, but instead with a true community. And the true community is the community that Sir Walter Scott put forward in Ivanhoe. But not only Sir Walter Scott. This is the beginning of the historical novel. And the historical novel will deal with the Middle Ages, a mixture of nature and Christianity, but always a community of affinity, like in Sir Walter Scott's Ivanhoe, Robin Hood and his merry men. But you can go beyond Robin Hood, as we will, because that community is not only a community of men and nature and adventure and Christian virtue, like compassion for the poor, it is also a community directly linked to Christianity, and above all to Catholic Christianity. The man who did more than anyone else to popularize this link was Chateaubriand, and his book, The Beauty of Christianity, of 1802. Now notice what Chateaubriand wants to do. He wants to rehabilitate Catholicism after the French Revolution. He wants to rehabilitate something that seemed to be defeated and despised. And he doesn't call his apologetic for Christianity the truth of Christianity, or something like that. He calls it the beauty of Christianity. And the title itself is important. The title itself is, if you like, a program. Because by beauty, Chateaubriand understood grandeur. He understood the awesomeness, the grandeur, the kind of nature that people searched in their quest for the Alps, which I talked about a few lectures ago, in their rush to the Alps, or the kind of beauty that Werther saw in the waterfall. Religion must be grandeur, grandeur. And so what Chateaubriand is after is the truth of Christianity through its grandeur. And the grandeur of Christianity is, because it is, in a way, passionate, mysterious. quite different than, let us say, the town, the factory. But it goes further than that. It is, from the beginning, an emotional religion. And as we are about to enter the church, writes Chateaubriand, let us first speak of the bells which summon us thither. To us it seems not a little surprising that a method should have been found by a single stroke of a hammer to excite the same sentiment at one and the same time, instant, in thousands of hearts, and to make the winds and clouds the bearers of the thoughts of men. Here in the church bells, you have this vision, both of nature, but above all of a community of affinity. The bells of the churches excite the same sentiment at one and the same instant in thousands of hearts. And this is carried by the sky. So you have the annexation of many things from eternity, the sky and Christianity, and the same sentiments beating in everybody's breast. But Chateaubriand goes further than that. Christianity is awesome also through its organization, through its hierarchy. It combines sentiment with order. And that was, of course, necessary to have a community of affinity. If you didn't have order, you might have an end like Werther's. You might have death and suicide. So order is necessary, but order based on common sentiment. And therefore, hierarchy is necessary. And what is better than the hierarchy of the Catholic Church? A hierarchy that is both a hierarchical system and based on a thousand hearts with the same rhythm. We will venture to assert that no other religion upon earth ever exhibited such a system of benevolence, prudence, and foresight, of energy and mildness, of moral and religious law. Nothing is more wisely instituted than those circles which, commencing with the meanest village clerk, keep continually rising up to the pontifical throne, which they support and by which they are crowned. The church thus affords relief by its different degrees for all our wants and all our distresses, arts, letters, science, legislation, politics, illustrious men of all classes. All these important benefits we derive from the higher ranks of the hierarchy, while the blessing of charity and morality were diffused by the subordinate degrees among the inferior classes of people. In other words, the church hierarchy diffuses down from letters, arts, and science in the higher hierarchy to compassion and charity towards the lower orders of people. It is an ideal hierarchy, ideal because it is linked by culture, by common sentiment. We shall see more of the importance of this. By common sentiment, by culture, ideal. And finally, he sums it up, the beauty of Christianity. With respect to ourselves, he writes, we are convinced that Christianity will rise triumphant from the dreadful trial by which it has been purified, the French Revolution, of course, the dreadful trial. What gives us this assurance is that it stands the test, and the more we examine it, the more we discover its grandeur. Its mysteries explain man and nature. Its actions support its precepts. Its charity in a thousand forms has succeeded the cruelty of the ancients. It has lost nothing of the pomp of antiquity, and its ceremonies give greater satisfaction to the heart and the imagination. We are indebted to it for everything. Letters, science, agriculture, and the fine arts. It connects morality with religion and man with God. Now notice, the enemy is antiquity. the classical revival, which was so important in the French Revolution, which had seen a revival of Roman art and Roman representation. And instead of the classics, it is Christianity. And the classics here are connected with rules and regulation. And what is important about Christianity is the more we examine it, the more we discover its grandeurs, its mysteries. So that you have in the beauty of Christianity, beauty defined as grandeur, as mystery, and as hierarchy, beauty and order, a community of affinity. Romanticism saw a Catholic Renaissance all over Europe. In France, in England, with the Oxford movement, the so-called Oxford movement in England, but a similar Catholic Renaissance in France and in Germany as well, because it was Catholicism which inspired, not Protestantism, not the state church, not a church without hierarchy, but the Catholic Church, which combined beauty and order. And we shall see when we come to Hegel that for the 19th century, beauty and order will be the same. They will be identical. That is to say, the kind of beauty in nature for which Werther searched and in which he did not find personal fulfillment, combined with the search for order. And that search for beauty and the search for order, which is a search for fulfillment, for an ordered life, meant in the end a community of affinity, a community of affinity as over against the enlightened despots of the 18th century or the new state, the new pragmatism, which, after all, we have studied. Together with it, of course, comes an artistic renaissance, which again starts to integrate things. Always this idea of integration. You can see Romanticism as an effort to integrate with something after the French Revolution, as an effort to integrate with something. Werther tried to integrate with nature and failed, obviously. Failed. Now you want to integrate not only with nature, but also with history. And you do it through the Catholic Church, and you do it through the total work of art. This is the time of the growth of an entirely new art form, the opera. And the opera is another attempt at integration. Integration of song and music and staging. All three are integrated in the opera. Song, music, and staging, and this will remain so. That is why it is idiotic to give opera in modern staging. They were all composed together. Music, words, and staging, of course. So the opera is a matter of integration in the art form. And before that, the song, the lead, was quite unknown until the end of the 18th century to integrate poetry and music in this particular way. So there's always the effort to integration. Werther didn't sing and he didn't compose opera. He integrated with nature and he committed suicide. Others like Gluck and then Weber in the end composed opera as a sign of integration. And the climax of that will, of course, be Richard Wagner later. But as a way of integration, you could do that. Another way of integration is architecture, the imitation not of the ancients, but of the Middle Ages. By and large, the famous architects like Pugin in England, who built the Houses of Parliament, Westminster, which you must have seen a lot, and, of course, at the beginning of the 19th century, two cathedrals which had been abandoned were finished. The Cathedral of Cologne and the Cathedral of Milan. The two cathedrals which had been abandoned were finished. And dreadful they are. Well, never mind. They were finished, and you can see it, that they are not real. Middle Ages, if you ever go and look at them. Similarly, the mania of the nobility to build castles. You know that from Ludwig of Bavaria. All right, that's pretty late. He built medieval castles, Neuschwanstein, all of these things. But long before Ludwig of Bavaria built his famous castles as a tourist attraction nowadays, many others from the beginning of the second century, from the beginning, built their new castles in a medieval way. So that, as you know, if you go to Germany and see a medieval castle, I bet you something to donuts that it's a 19th century thing and not a medieval castle. You realize that. So this mania for building in the Middle Ages. But typically enough, as you'll see later, only one public document was, public building was built like a medieval castle. That's the Houses of Parliament in England. Because as you'll see later, the nation will continue the classical tradition. But the medieval Houses of Parliament in England, where the Gothic revival, as we call it, the Gothic revival was strongest, there even the national symbol, the Houses of Parliament, were rebuilt like a cathedral in a Gothic fashion. They are inside, if you've been, like a cathedral. At the same time, of course, you have it in painting, and you could go through all of the arts, and of course, in literature, the historical novel. All of these things, I have no time to go into. You can read them in the relevant chapters in my Culture of Western Europe. First of all, therefore, this search for community meant a search for history, the Middle Ages. It had to be the Middle Ages. The Baroque had to be rejected. The Baroque is nervous, not calming, like a medieval cathedral. The Baroque is a nervous style. They rejected the Baroque. They hated the Baroque, a hate which will continue till after the Second World War, by the way. This hatred of the Baroque as a nervous style, not worth regarding or writing about or anything like that. So they hated the Baroque. They had to go back to the Middle Ages, but they went because of Christianity then, Catholicism, and it fuses with the mystery of nature. Of course, it fuses in symbolism. It fuses in the blue flower that I told you before. The blue flower, remember, is a symbol of salvation and utopia. But blue, as you may remember, is, you won't remember at all, a stupid thing to say, blue is the mantle of the Virgin Mary. And if you don't believe it, look at the Raphael paintings. Paintings which, and I'll come to it in another connection, had a big revival now. Raphael was being rediscovered at the same time. And so you have blue, the mantle of the Virgin Mary, and blue as a kind of symbol of salvation through nature, a kind of symbol of something that stands outside time. So it one thing plays into another. But secondly, and for us most importantly, the worship of the distant past tended to become the worship of the national community. And to this we must now address ourselves. For what we are coming to now is the origin of modern nationalism. And as nationalism will never change at all, the origins will determine its end. It will never change. Even in its expressions, it won't change. Just as now, let us say, to give one example, the folk dance becomes an expression of nationalism. So all new nations, including Israel, has the folk dance as an expression of the new nationalism. Nationalism is the most boring of all ideologies. It's interesting at its beginning, to which we now come, but it will have no development. It will have no development. Its whole idea is that it is a blue flower. Its whole idea is that it's eternal. So something that is supposed to be eternal cannot really develop from its discovery. so that the symbols, the actions, the thing you do to underline your national identity, all of these things have not really greatly changed. And that goes from the fire symbolism of the holy flame, which is again a nature symbolism and a Christian symbolism, the holy flame over the altar in churches, and the flame is nature. From the holy flame, if you like, to folk dances, to fairy tales, I'll come to them at the minute, through all of this, there isn't a great deal of change. Now again, the search for a common national community grew out of the search for a community of affinity. And it starts in France with the French Revolution, with a political event. But in the rest of Europe, and especially in Central Europe, with literature, with the rediscovery of the ballads. In England, the most important rediscovery of the ballads is Percy's Relics. The relics of Percy, which were the rediscovery of the ballads in England in 1765. And then, of course, in Germany with fairy tales. And finally, the great collection of fairy tales, which you are all familiar, perhaps Grimm's fairy tales of 1810. So you get a rediscovery of a lost literature, of a lost tradition, in this search for the Middle Ages, for that community. And you rediscover it not through politics. And when you have in France a political event, it rediscovers the Romans, because the French Revolution couldn't very well fasten on to the French kings and popes and French history. So the French Revolution was really a Roman discovery, rediscovered the ancients. But in the rest of Europe, this search for a community of affinity led almost logically to a kind of national affinity. And it was Rousseau, as we shall see, who first used the term the people in its modern sense. So that you get the search for this. Now, the fairy tales, the ballads, the folk songs became a sign that there had been a kind of community in the long distant past, and that this community had been a community of language. Come back to that, because language becomes the key to nationality. A community of language, and that it had been a vibrant community. Really, people were discovering a past culture which gave them a history mysterious and of grandeur. We must remember that Grimm's fairy tales were not written for children. It is only by the late 19th century that they became read to children, only when they had lost their original meaning. Their original meaning is a meaning which is highly symbolic. Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs is a story of the goddess Freya, the goddess of light, fighting the god of darkness. As the Grimms wrote these fairy tales, they were highly symbolic of a Germanic past, of gods, of ghosts, of this kind of thing, to be taken seriously as history of the past and not to be read to children. Yes, excuse me, sir. Yes. The question is whether the French Revolution's rediscovery of the Roman past meant that Novalis and the other Germans romantics, in their search for community, reacted against it. Yes, there's an odd sort of double play. In Germany and England, the French Revolution, as I told you before, was regarded as the height of immorality. And against the French Revolution, you have this new kind of imagery of a morality, the flower imagery of the red rose that I talked to you about, yes, of chastity, the blue flower, yes, all of these against the reality. While in fact, the Jacobin had a terrific moral rigorism, you know that. The Jacobin were the most, were really the first and most rigorous in morality. But the enemies did not see that. Enemies never see that. We say the immoral Soviet, when in reality the Soviet Union has a much more rigorous and oppressive system of moral legislation than we. The Soviet Union would be today, I suppose, the paradise for the Reverend Farewell, if he only knew it. It is tremendously repressive, sexually and otherwise, of course, a moral rigor. But those who fight against another nation always think of its immorality since the French Revolution. They take it for granted, however much in practice it might be totally wrong. You see what I mean? So yes, to a certain extent. But I think we can't put it all down to the French Revolution. I think the new morality is very important as reflecting, as I told you, the reaction against the French Revolution. I think this search for community, medieval, Christian, and national, that goes beyond it. That is search for a new kind of mooring in an age where you lose your mooring through all the things that we've told, industrialization, the speed of time, all these underlying social realities which were changing very fast, yes? And which I told about so much. I think that generates its own efforts, yes? Its own effort as finding a kind of mooring. And when the ballads and the fairy tales and the folk dances and the folk songs were rediscovered, people felt a kind of mooring. They felt a kind of community that wasn't artificial. We mustn't be too abstract here ourselves and too theoretical. There is something to it that when you dance a folk dance, you feel a community with the other dancers, no? Otherwise, why do you dance folk dancing? It's a long time since I did it. When I went to Harvard, we used to have, as a graduate student, you need it as a graduate student. Graduate study disorients you. It's supposed to do so. So once a week, Harvard University, which like most university then in those days still amounted to something, had a weekly folk dance, you see, which we all went to, because it did give us a sense of community, a sense of community. And I suppose that's why some of you go in for Israeli folk dancing. It gives you a sense of community. So remember, there's always a real basis to this. If this, what I'm telling you now, whether it is Chateaubriand's Christianity or Gothic architecture and so on, they fulfill a need. They are, you see what I mean, a reality. Otherwise, they would have never become important in history. Otherwise, they would have been another curious notions. And there are millions of curious notions a minute. You see. That's not what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with things that amounted to something that formed us and formed our culture. So there must be a reality behind it, yes, a reality behind it that makes you want to integrate in this particular manner and that has meaning for a lot of people, not for all, but for a lot of people. So that is what I'm after. And this is true for ballads and folk dances and these fairy tales. People rediscovered their past. Now, in a time of great confusion, people want to rediscover their past. Remember what I said before I go on to Herder. Remember what I said before, that in the 19th century, history becomes a main organizing principle of people's lives, and therefore of political thought. Therefore, all thought in the 19th century is really historical thought. Marxism is a historical theory. Hegel, as you'll see, is a historical theory. All these things are historical theories, and the historical novel, and this looking backward, this search for community, is a historical search. So history becomes an organizing principle, and therefore people try to find an affinity. They try to find a history to which they belong. And the more disturbed the times, the more necessary this becomes. The more they are not content with a merely horizontal organization, excuse me. They want a vertical organization. Now, you can see this about the awakening today. The first sign of black awakening was a quest for black history, a history that had been, as it were, suppressed or unknown, and that was discovered, being discovered. And you can say the same thing today with lesbian history or homosexual history. There are these histories which have to be discovered. And I suppose that people at the beginning of the 19th century had an attitude not unsimilar to the blacks or gays or lesbians today, because you mustn't forget one other big fact, which I have almost assumed too much, that during all of this discovery, Central Europe was engaged in wars of national liberation. And Mr. Levine, for your question, that is much more relevant. What really formed this, what made it go, this kind of national integration, was that at the wars against the French Revolution were at the same time wars of national liberation. They were even so regarded in England, which was already unified. They were certainly so regarded in Central Europe. And if you get all this together, the wars of national liberation and the disorientation they brought, the enthusiasm of discovery that you have a history you never knew about, which led, not as it does today, to polemics. We can say this about women's history. Well, this is only going up on the radio. I won't be lynched. I'll be in Jerusalem when it's broadcast. So, thank God. Anyhow, so I'll say this. All new history, black history, it may have occurred to you, woman's history, gay history, lesbian history, at first it's exaggerated. People make too much of it. It becomes polemical. But you can say the same for the beginning of the 19th century. Only they didn't express it in these polemics. They expressed it in the poetry of national liberation, in Theodor Körner, in Germany, Max von Schenkendorf, poets of national liberation. Yes, they expressed it too. It was exaggerated. Of course, a new discovery always tends to be exaggerated because you have found a process by which you can order your life. You found a process which can order life. But this is relatively new. This is relatively new. Nobody in the 18th or 17th century had a need to order their lives this way. Why? Because I think religion still had a real force. And I must add this. It's not only the disturbed times, the wars of national liberation, the French Revolution, the industrialization, which all coincided to make a certain disorientation which plays into Romanticism. It isn't only all of these factors, I think, which are involved here. There is also, I think, another factor apart from the revolution and all of this that is involved here. And this is that religion in the Romantic era becomes too general. After all, what is Chateaubriand? He doesn't give you a theology. He praises the hierarchy, the grandeur, and the beauty. And for many people, this became much too general. You needed something much more specific to integrate yourself with. I mean, it's all right to spend half an hour in a Gothic cathedral, catch bronchitis. But in a Gothic cathedral, it's all right to spend half an hour. But is it really a principle by which you can order your life? And it's all very well to make nature in your own image, yes? It's all very well, like Werther, to have the waterfall correspond to your own mood. But again, it doesn't really integrate you to anything in these times. And it's all very well to climb the Alps and to think you're integrated with nature and that you have passed the test of your manliness, as I said. But it doesn't really satisfy the need for integration. It has to be more specific. And what I'm coming to, the nation provided something more specific. A more specific literature, a more specific language, a more specific community, a community which had direction. And though, as I just read you, Chateaubriand talks at length about hierarchy, the beauty of the hierarchy, that's not enough. You need more than hierarchy. You need more than hierarchy. And here in the fairy tales, in the ballads, in the folk songs, you had more than hierarchy. You had language. You had something specific. Now, the man who pulled it all together, and the man whom we may call the awakener of nationality, not only in Germany, but in Poland, among the Czechs, among the Hungarians, that is Herder. And it is to Herder I must come, because he pulled it together. He is, if you like, the great synthesizer of this feeling, this longing for community and a directed community. And it is through Herder that not only the Germans were awakened to their nationality, but also the Poles, the Czechs, and in a last resort, the Jews. Now, all of these will deny it, of course, because you can't be awakened to your nationality by a bloody foreigner. But that is still the truth. That is still the truth. That everywhere it is Herder, and then the second man I will talk about, Fichte, who awakened. At the beginning of the modern Jewish national awakening stands a famous essay that all Jews must be like Fichte. Today, that wouldn't be very popular, would it? But anyhow, however that might be, it is still true that through Herder and Fichte, all of Central Europe and all the nationalities which were offshoots of Central Europe were awakened. Even in Russia, they had a tremendous effect. And so with this, we must get to Herder, to Herder's ideas, which were so important because they summarize this kind of community. If Chateaubriand summarized the religious, Herder summarized the national. But it is very typical that Herder did so not only from romanticism. Sure, Herder was a romantic, but Herder was also a pietist. Herder is one of those, and we shall be constantly dealing with them from now on, who was educated in a parsonage. Hegel will be another one we shall come to very soon. Fichte is another one. All these had this pietistic education, inwardly directed against politics, inwardly, which fitted in very well with Germany at the time, which had no hope for political unity, whose only hope was, after all, a cultural unity. In other words, Herder became the prophet of disunited people because he gave them a principle of unity outside politics. All the people who had no hope of becoming a united people, or no hope of becoming a people as it looked from 1820, 1830, found in Herder a principle of unity which gave them hope, a principle which was not political. And here I think the parsonage had a lot to do with it. That education, which is even true in Hegel, despite his enthusiasm for the French Revolution, this principle of, you like, looking for something outside politics. Now for Herder.
For Herder, the powerful forces which shape men and history
are not reason, of course, but as he puts it, deep, massive sentiment. So he is, of course, a romantic in this, we shall see. He's an Enlightenment figure in some other respects, but in this he is a romantic. The powerful forces which shape man and history are not reason, but deep sentiment.
And again he says something that might have taken right out of Werther, right out of Werther. The more private the experience, the deeper the truth.
That you can see in all of Werther. The more private the experience, the deeper the truth. After all, the blue flower is a very private experience. The more private the experience, the deeper the truth, the more you look into your heart, the deeper the truth.
But Herder modifies this individualism, if you like, in two respects.
No experience can be private. Every private experience is at the same time, coincidentally, if you like, an experience of history and an experience of the folk.
Now, that is a term I shall use for people. You will see why, because they are different. The same of the folk, let's spell it in its true way, an experience of the folk, an experience of your folk, which is more than merely the experience of the people.
Now Herder was a Lutheran. He was brought up in a Lutheran parsonage. He was by profession a Lutheran minister, as was Hegel. They were Lutheran ministers, and therefore he believed that history followed a divine plan. History followed a divine plan, and he shocked the 18th century. He shocked by holding that despotism in ancient times were justified. If history follows a divine plan, everything that is justified. And so despotisms were justified in ancient times because ancient times are the childhood of the people, the childhood of humanity. Something Karl Marx will repeat again. It becomes very important, this view of the ancients as the kind of childhood of humanity. We shall come back to that.
But Herder now returns to childhood again and in a different context. In childhood, he finds a link between people. And the link between people, which he finds, is the link of language. Language, for Herder, is the repository of the childhood of a people. And that means it's a repository of the experience of a people. Language is the repository of the experience of the people. Language, therefore, gives a sense of nationality. There are, he says, obviously, but then it was new, no two identical languages. Therefore, language produces a natural, instinctive spontaneity.
Now remember, the 18th century had, the Enlightenment had rejected all that for its cosmopolitanism. The Enlightenment have said, that is old superstition. Let us have one common language, French in this case. Let us have one common language. But Herder caught up in this German revival, awakening already, has to reject this common French language. And so he becomes very aware of the differences of languages. Yes, indeed. And aware of childhood. Because if history is the divine plan, then childhood is part of it. Then it is part of the divine plan that there are more than one language, that there are no two identical languages. Therefore, he draws another conclusion, which becomes important, a conclusion which is a leap in a way. Language, therefore, produces a natural, instinctive spontaneity. It produces a cohesiveness which is based not on rules and regulation, but on spontaneity. He believed the way a child learns a language is spontaneous. He believes the way a child expresses himself is spontaneous. Therefore, the expressions of a childhood of a people are also spontaneous. Therefore, ballads and fairy tales are the best and most spontaneous expression of a people, because they are the expressions of a childhood of a people. And he constantly draws the analogy of a childhood of children, if you like, and a childhood of a people. Both are filled with spontaneity, with a common language, and with a feeling, he thought, of uniqueness. Now here, if you like, Herder has found the entry into a cohesive factor which will mitigate the loneliness of private experience. Which will mitigate the loneliness of private experience on the basis of spontaneity. Of the basis of a cohesiveness founded on spontaneity. Founded on a common childhood. That's really it. A common childhood. And that common childhood, which Germans and Czechs and Poles and English have in common, that common childhood is expressed by ballads, by fairy tales, by folk dancing, by the innocence, the innocence, the innocence of a spontaneous experience, devoid of aggression, devoid of evil intent. The goddess of light in Snow White wins over the god of darkness. So, a devoid of evil intent. The individual, therefore, becomes a part of this kind of spontaneity. And if he sings ballads, if he sings fairy tales, if he dances folk dances, which are now being rediscovered, and at times even if he wears folk costume, which also had a revival, folk costume, then he integrates himself with the youth of his people, with the youth of his people, with their spontaneity before corruption had set in, before oppression had set in, before its history was expedited by the evil French, the evil Christians, or whatever, the evil whatever expurgated people, because in this rediscovery, there are always the evils who oppress. There must be the evils who oppress. And of course, again, this isn't a way reality. The evil Enlightenment, which was the evil French, and eventually the evil Christianity, because the church had its own history. And in the history of the church, Grimm's fairy tales have no place. Grimm's fairy tales have no place, nor have Percy's relics. Therefore, you get two competing histories, the history of your childhood, the history of the church. And the idea is already with the brothers Grimm and others that the church oppresses the history of your childhood. So there is this feeling of rediscovery, of spontaneity, this exaggerated feeling. But unlike today, I think, a feeling without any aggression, because there's no aggression in Herder, none at all. He is still cosmopolitan. Every people has its own legitimate history, legitimate childhood. And I guess, as I said at the beginning, today, with the revival of black history and women's history, and gay and lesbian history, we can perhaps realize this. But one thing is missing. One thing is missing, perhaps because it comes earlier. One thing is missing is The polemic is there. It is a romantic polemic. But what is missing is the aggressiveness. Because this is not political. This has a pietistic background. It is not political. It tries to build on a cultural basis. And therefore, it misses what we would call the sharp political edge, which you have in these 2 days. But the joy of discovery, which is the joy of integration, the end of loneliness, that I think is the same.